Welcome to episode 19 of Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and every Monday I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. We talk about how they became motivated to act on climate change, what they are doing to help, and their vision for the future. My guest today is Howard Newman, CEO at Pinebrook and trustee of the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. A few years ago, Howard discussed the potential for leveraging the carbon sequestering capabilities of plants with Dr. Joanne Chory at the Salk Institute. She and a team of scientists, with the help of funding from Howard, are now leading the Harnessing Plants initiative, leveraging plants to increase their carbon sequestering behavior. Amy, can you talk about what carbon sequestration means to you?
Well, there's a lot of carbon in the world, and sometimes the carbon doesn't get along, so they have to be sequestered. They have to be separated from the other carbons and the other elements. And by keeping the carbons separate, we can get on with what we need to do as humans, which is to conquer the Earth. So carbons, get out of our way, or you will be sequestered.
Amy, unfortunately, I think those darn carbons are mingling a bit much with the hydrogens and oxygens and might be the ones conquering the Earth. Amy owns Finest City Improv in Hillcrest, San Diego. Looking for more fun and laughter in your life? Or maybe even a little more courage? Finest City Improv, FCI, is the place to laugh it out. Improv comedy shows 4 nights a week, plus classes for all levels. You can even bring FCI to work with a fun, engaging, and highly effective team-building workshop. Learn more at finestcityimprov.com. Carbon sequestration is the capturing of carbon dioxide from or before it gets into the atmosphere and storing it for the long term as a solid or a liquid. One geological process is to capture CO2 at a source, such as a power plant, and pressurize it into a liquid and then inject it into porous rock formations in geographic basins. Biological methods include growing algae and using it to make surfboards or other products like that, or growing and then storing, not burning, large trees. And of course, the amazing harnessing plants method you will hear about in this podcast. If you have an alternative, entertaining definition of carbon sequestration, please visit my Twitter account at Lee Krivat and retweet the tweet for this episode, episode 19, with Howard Newman, and retweet your definition with the hashtag LearnAterm. If you make me laugh, I'll include it in the next Climate Champions episode. That's at Lee Krivat, retweet episode 19, hashtag LearnAterm, and make me laugh. And from last week's Learn a Term, Lead Platinum, my brother Matthew again comes through, this time with a Star Trek reference, thinking it might have been a proprietary brand of gold-pressed latinum for use on DS9 space station. And now some exciting late-breaking news. While Howard and I were talking in New York City, the Salk Institute's Harnessing Plants Initiative, the one we're about to talk about, that combats climate change by using plants, and led by Joanne Chory, announced funding of more than $35 million from over 10 individuals and organizations through the Audacious Project, a highly competitive program housed at TED, the nonprofit devoted to ideas worth spreading. Wow! Congratulations! Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and I am talking with Howard Newman. He is the CEO of Pinebrook, and he's also a trustee of the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. I'm so excited to be talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
So with regards to climate change, can you talk about a meaningful moment or meaningful moments that caused you to feel like you needed to do something different?
Yes, there were a number of events which got me interested in the climate issue. It was probably 3 or 4 years ago, my wife and I were riding with Joanne Chory, who's a senior scientist at the Salk Institute. And Joanne was explaining the problems which the warming Earth were creating for agriculture. Joanne's claim to fame is identifying how plants grow, how they use light to grow. And she was explaining the challenges of how we would feed the world in a warming world. For example, I didn't know, but when the temperature gets above 85 or 88 degrees, corn stops growing. So as the earth continues to warm, we're not going to be able to grow corn where we are growing it now. And Joanne, who's a specialist in light, was working on helping plants adapt to a warmer environment. They'd have to move north, but then they'd get different amounts of light, so they'd have to use light differently. And she was going on at great length.
It's like when you push one side of a balloon and it pops out somewhere else.
Absolutely. And she was explaining, you know, how she was working with plants to make them adapt. And I looked at her and said, well, Joanne, plants absorb carbon dioxide all the time, right? Why don't you work on having plants solve the problem rather than adapt to the problem? And nothing came from that for a year or so. And then a year or so later, I was meeting with her at another time, and I said, Joanne, let me explain the carbon cycle to you differently than you probably think about it. I said, most people think of the carbon cycle as humans emitting now 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the air every year, and the Earth absorbing 20, which leaves us with 20 too many gigatons going into the air each year, and that's 2.5 parts per million. And so in 25 years, that's a lot of carbon dioxide.
A lot of carbon, yeah.
We're all toast. I said, but if you think about that carbon cycle a little bit differently, you may have a different approach to the problem. I said, in particular, that 20 number is not a gross number. It's a net number. The 20 is the result of the Earth actually absorbing 760 gigatons a year and then re-releasing 740. So maybe there's a way you can address the problem by making plants either absorb more or reduce less.
Because they're already absorbing a lot.
They're already absorbing 760 gigatons a year versus the 40 which humans emit. So plants have the capacity to basically take all the excess carbon dioxide out of the air. Unfortunately, they release most of it back. So the next puzzle we faced was...
And when you say they release most of it back, what do you mean?
So a plant, when it grows, it takes carbon dioxide out of the air. It turns it into sugars and other things. But when the plant dies,
right,
it releases it back. So over its life cycle, a plant is net zero. It absorbs and then releases. But over the life cycle of all plants, they're not net zero. Somehow something interferes with plants releasing all of that carbon dioxide back into the air. And if you think about that, there are two reasons why plants don't completely decompose. Either they get buried in a place where they don't get absorbed by bugs, there's not enough oxygen, or they've manufactured material which doesn't degrade. And so I asked Joanne to think about whether or not they could modify plants so they did more of those two things. And they went away and they came back and they said, this is not a very hard problem. This is a problem which nature has not addressed, people have not addressed. We think modern biology can address it. So we set about trying to create plants which would absorb more carbon dioxide and then bury that carbon dioxide in a form where it would not decompose in the relevant time frame.
You know, what's really exciting me, I just have to say, is I knew that you were helping financially with the Salk Institute in this research. I did not know that you contributed to the ideas, or you kicked off the ideas.
Well, I kicked off the ideas to where they should look. I didn't have anything to do with the science.
No, I understand, but that's still tremendous.
In fact, my first idea was that they should get coral to grow in a wider range. Coral, you know, only grows in the sea between 78 and 82 degrees. And I'm a diver, and I see coral, and there's lots of it. And I mean, I know something about the oil and gas business. I know coral traps a lot of oil and gas. So I suggested that they actually get coral to grow in a wider range of temperatures. And they kind of looked at me and said, it's a great idea, Howard, but, you know, coral's an animal, and we're plant biologists. So that didn't go very far with that idea.
Okay,
So I challenged them. But, you know, the Salk scientists came back on their own. They came up with the ideas of burying this stuff. And they came up with the idea that they want plants to produce something known as suberin more frequently. Now, suberin, you and I know, is cork. And the reason they discovered cork as the kind of plant material that they would like to produce was one of the other scientists at the Salk, John Well, was meandering around his ancestral home by his compost heap. And he discovered that cork doesn't dissolve. And he went back and he studied it and discovered, lo and behold, cork as a material just doesn't dissolve. It's a very stable polymer with lots of carbon in it. And so if you can induce plants to produce more cork, more suberin, not more cork, more suberin, you could actually get plants involved in burying large amounts of carbon without just by doing what they normally do. And it turns out that all plants produce suberin. They just produce it in very different amounts. The cork oak produces a lot of it. Mangoes grows, trees produce a lot of it. Cantaloupes actually have it in their rinds, but all plants do it, and they produce it in response to stress. So the challenge that the Salk came up with was to get plants to produce more of this suberin in their roots, make bigger roots so they can produce more suberin, and then bury those roots. And in this way, we think that we can actually make a meaningful contribution to carbon sequestration, that some of the estimates the Salk has done are that we could absorb 10 gigatons of carbon dioxide a year. That's half of the problem, using just 9 common crops. And we think this can be done in 10 to 15 years and at a cost which could be as low as $10 a ton. So it's just a breathtakingly different approach to the carbon problem. And so you asked me why I got excited about it. I got excited about it because I saw a solution to a problem which we have to solve. Didn't seem to me that we could solve the problem solely through changing behavior, through changing technology. We needed to have a different solution. And plants are hiding in plain sight. You know, plants exist to pull carbon dioxide out of the air, to produce products with it. So why not just get plants to do more of what they already do?
It just
seemed super exciting stuff. So plants, the natural solution to carbon change.
Well, I'm really excited that you had that conversation with Joanne and that it led to something so amazing.
And she took it off, and her co-faculty members, they've approached this like it's a problem which they can do something about, and they can.
It's a world-changing problem,
world-changing
solution.
And it's an approach which really nobody else has. The way we describe it is most carbon sequestration technologies, they have a half-cycle approach, especially the ones which are biological-based. They want to grow more biomass, and by growing more biomass, clearly you sequester more carbon. But the problem is those plants will eventually die. And so they're only looking at half the problem, whereas the Salk is looking over the entire life cycle of the plant, both when it grows and when it dies. And it's decided the easier problem is to work on it, what happens when it dies. And the answer is, let's not let it decompose. Let's bury it, and let's bury it with suberin. And when we do that, we create better soil, probably better yields, more drought resistant, more insect resistant, more flood tolerant. It's kind of like the Salk scientists have come up with an anti-gravity machine which cures cancer and repeals the second law of thermodynamics all at the same time. It just seems too good to be true, but it's not.
I've seen what they've been doing with my own eyes.
They can do it, and they've made great progress in the past year, and in the next 2 or 3 years, they'll make more.
Why is this personally important to you?
Well, it's personally important to me because I've got children and grandchildren. You know, that we clearly have to do something about the amount of carbon dioxide which is accumulating in the atmosphere. And we don't have to blame anybody. We know that humans need energy to prosper. And the more they prosper, the more energy they need. And we know that there are billions of people on this earth who want to become prosperous. And it's just not reasonable to expect poor people to want to remain poor. So we need a solution which is consistent with developing the world, consistent with the natural nature of people to want to grow and become rich, but yet doesn't just kind of shake your head and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, because the world has actually been focused on this problem for 30 years. And in that 30 years, we've made remarkable progress with respect to conservation and efficiency. You would not know that by reading the paper, but if you look at the amount of carbon which the world produces for every dollar of GDP, since 1989, that is down 60%.
You have LED light bulbs.
LED light bulbs.
Starting to see solar and wind.
More efficient cars, better weight. Okay.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, the number of GDPs is up 4 times. So even though we're conserving at the rate of 3% a year, which is a remarkable amount of technology, we're growing faster than that. And so in the 30 years that we've been making progress at the rate of, 3% a year, unfortunately, emissions have doubled. So if you just project out a world which is growing, we have to have a different approach to this. We have to have an approach which is scalable and which is here now. Otherwise, it's going to be really problematic for my children and grandchildren.
Yeah, before you said we're going to be toast. So you obviously understand the issues at stake. How do you explain to others what those issues are and why this is so important?
I've never been faced with the challenge of explaining to somebody why a warming Earth is a problem. That seems to be self-evident.
I'll tell you, I was talking to a CEO the other day who was challenging that. He wanted more proof. He said there isn't enough proof out there.
I don't think the argument's worth having. We know that carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is increasing. We can debate how much of that is humans, how much of that is natural. We can debate whether this very small change in the atmosphere will have catastrophic impact or not. But there's no reason to have the debate. There's no reason to have the debate because we can do something about it. We can do something about it at a cost which is not prohibitive. This solution, which we're working on at the Salk, is available for maybe nothing, maybe for $10 a ton. Okay. It's an amount which is bearable by the world's economy without interfering with the aspirations of the people. So there's no reason not to do it. There's no reason not to try to make the Earth cleaner. And we know when we turn our attention to matters, put our shoulder to the wheel, our nose to the grindstone, we can clean up the air. We cleaned up the rivers in this country. We cleaned up the air in this country. We got rid of the fog in London. We did lots of things because we decided we could do them. We stopped fighting about them. So I want to be involved with something which enables people to see a solution rather than a debate. We could solve the climate problem in this world, right? We have a lot of solutions available to us, right? We could have nuclear power. We don't have nuclear power, right? We could stop cutting down forests. We don't want to do that, right? We have many technologies available to us, but somehow we have a debate rather than a desire to solve the problem. So I think what this biological contribution does is gives us another tool, which makes it easier to say we can have a solution rather than have a debate.
Whatever it takes to get everybody on the same page, let's just do it.
Right. And there's no reason to have a debate about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's interesting to me is industry gets a bad rap here, but industry is spending billions of dollars to solve this problem, which most people are unaware of. I mean, the amount of work which is going on carbon sequestration, on carbon capture technologies and things like that, it really is quite a lot of work going on. The problem is that most of it requires changes in technology, or it requires changes in economics. It requires massive carbon taxes. And a carbon tax is fine, except it's regressive. It's not good for people. So we need a solution which is not going to hurt people. You know, I'm not one of those climate advocates who think that the people who pollute are bad. People who produce pollute are people. So you got to work with that construct. And so let's give them the tools they can have to solve this problem.
So the pollution had the consequence of doing what it's done today to the mm-hmm. environment, but it's also economically made our lives easier as a people, made us healthier, made us live longer. I think now we just have to find a way to get it back in balance.
We have to find a way to get it back in balance. And the problem is, in the West, we are very carbon conscious. I mean, the U.S. today produces a lot less carbon than it did 25 years ago, largely because we backed coal out of the system and put natural gas into the system.
Because the price fell.
We're going to move to a low-carbon world. We're going to move to a non-carbon world. But we have to have a time frame and a reasonable path to get there.
So all arrows in the quiver.
All
that's
arrows
what I
in
say.
The quiver.
I'm not the only one who says
all arrows in the quiver. I mean, the easy quivers are to get rid of coal, right? The easy arrows to get rid of coal. There's no reason for there to be coal anywhere except for the fact that we don't have nuclear power and except for the fact that coal is cheap. So we could back coal out. And in this country, we're going to back coal out. We don't need to do it through regulation, through legislation. The economics of coal are just, they're just going to go away. Gas will put it out of its misery. Just give it a chance. Internationally, it's more of a problem because not everybody has those gas resources. So internationally, coal is continuing to grow. And people do such strange things. I mean, you know, Germany decided it was going to be clean, right? So it shut down its nukes. It got rid of this. So what does it do? It imports electricity generated by dirty coal from Poland and feels good about it because they're not producing the electricity.
Yeah, I think on the positive side, they definitely gave solar a shot in the arm and they led the way
wind.
In a
offshore
lot of
wind.
Things. Yeah, they did some exciting things, but there definitely have been negative side effects.
Yeah. So we should be better. I mean, we need a carbon price. I'm fine with that. I don't think the carbon price has to be as high as people think it needs to be, but we should put a price on carbon. I mean, if you're polluting, you should pay for it. That's not very complicated.
If you put a price on carbon, people are going to want to have their plants absorb more carbon and put it deep into the earth.
You know, the debate is the price on carbon, people are talking $50 a ton or $200 a ton. These are big numbers. I mean, the U.S., $50 a ton times 10 gigatons, there's $500 billion a year. That's just a tax. $500 billion a year. That would have complications for the U.S. economy. So it's important to find solutions where the tax is less than that. That's not going to drive all the carbon out of the world because people will pay the tax, but it'll drive enough of the carbon out of the world that we can have a world which heats slowly enough that we can move to a lower carbon environment over time. And there's a lot of urgency to move to a low carbon environment, but we have to understand what the countervailing forces are. It's just that
there's a lot of forces.
A lot of forces.
And ultimately, one way or another, they all have to be in balance
to get
to the end that we need.
And the unspoken villain in this piece are the consumers, right? We all consume energy, and energy releases carbon. So we all stop blaming everybody else, and we all just solve the problem. I think plants are a healthy way to solve the problem.
So you're CEO of Pinebrook. Please tell me what that has to do with harnessing plants for carbon sequestration.
So my professional life and my philanthropic life are separate in that sense that the Harnessing Plants Initiative is not related to my business. It's related to my role as a trustee of the Salk. Which is just an amazing institution. It's full of world-class scientists who will talk to you about their science in a way in which it's accessible. And so I've been involved with the Salk since 2002. I've been supporting plant biology since about 2005. Why am I supporting plant biology? Because it's long time been one of the premier faculties at the Salk, and it needed some recognition. And they said, why don't you help support plant biology. I met the plant biologist. I said, this is an easy decision. Well, let's just support this. And then over time, as I've gotten to know the scientists, I've gotten to appreciate that they can do wonderful things for the planet. We're going to make the planet so that it doesn't overheat. And their next challenge is to make sure that we can feed this planet.
So how did you get to where you are? What's your background?
So I grew up in York, Pennsylvania, 10 miles south of Three Mile Island. And I'm still in favor of nuclear power.
Well, it doesn't have any carbon.
Doesn't have any carbon. And if you do it right, it's okay.
There's a lot of people working on it.
Yes, there is. I mean, I think nuclear power is a devil, people think. They think it's a bogeyman. They think it's evil. Nuclear power is a technology. We have lots of nuclear power in this country. Our Navy runs on nuclear power. France is 90% nuclear power. We have to deal with it carefully. You have to make appropriate safeguards, but it's a technology per se. It's pretty good.
Yeah, there's a number of companies working on modular nukes that they could transport.
Modular nukes been around. It's been an idea. It's been here for a long period of time.
Yes,
it doesn't get enough support because people want a non-nuclear solution. To me, ruling out nuclear as a possible solution is like ruling out stem cells. You know, it's not a rational response. It's an emotional response. And we need more rational thinking about this subject. So you asked about my life.
I asked about your background.
Right, so I grew up in York, Pennsylvania. I went to a public high school. I did well. You know, I went to Yale. I majored in economics and philosophy. I spent a couple years at Cambridge and got a PhD from Harvard and then came to work in Wall Street. And I spent 10 years at a firm called Morgan Stanley when it was small, left when it got big, joined a firm called Warburg Pincus when it was small, left when it got big.
Sounds like maybe you helped get them big.
And started Pinebrook in 2006, and we're not yet big, so it's okay.
So you're still here a while.
So I'm still here. Okay.
Nice. So, how about any setbacks or challenges that you faced?
Well, life is always full of setbacks and challenges, right? So
otherwise, you're not trying enough, taking enough risks.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a venture capitalist, which means I invest in people's dreams. A lot of times those dreams become nightmares. That means you lose money. You have to deal with that. It's a tough challenge because every day is full of setbacks and challenges. Otherwise, the day's not very interesting.
Yeah. As I said, you're not taking enough risk, trying enough things. How about some successes?
Well, I think the fact that we're here having this conversation is kind of what the success is, right? you know, I've been part of three great organizations. I have a wonderful family, you know, two daughters, two granddaughters. So that's a lot of success there. But, you know, in my professional career, I've been helping create the private equity industry. When I joined it, it didn't have a name. And it had nothing to do with carbon, but the first transaction I worked on was an $8 million transaction. And it was too big for my firm to do it all. You know, these days, private equity is the industry du jour, right? And I played a small role in that and helped create the energy part of it. The way we finance energy companies is something I played a role in. So in Pine Brook, we create energy companies, we create banks, financial institutions. So I'm fond of saying we finance businesses which people love to hate but can't do without. So that's our business here.
Where do you see things in 20, 30, 40 years?
So I'm optimistic. I have to be optimistic. I'm a venture capitalist, right? I think we will solve the carbon problem. I think we will, and I know that's a minority view, okay? And I think we will solve the carbon problem in a way which is not economically disruptive to the world. It's just too important a problem for us not to do that. So in 30 or 40 years, we will probably have an economy which is has a much lower carbon footprint, has more carbon, low carbon or carbon-free generation. It'll have more efficient electric distribution so that we need less primary power to begin with. So I think we'll solve a lot of those problems. I'm pretty optimistic about that. I think we'll see the bigger challenge we'll face is what artificial intelligence and machine learning means to employment. And we're going to have to figure out how to create new jobs for people whose existing jobs are displaced. Historically, we've always been pretty good about that. What we have to worry about is that if we decide to do that from above rather than below. So if we have somebody sitting up there who's going to dictate what kind of jobs we're going to create and what kind of industries we're going to create, I think that's going to fail. I think you have to rely on the natural entrepreneurial talents of individuals to do what's in their best interest. I'm a free market guy, you can tell.
I can tell.
An invisible hand guy.
Yeah.
Well, it's just the evidence is overwhelming that allowing people to take advantage of their talents is a better way to get there than telling them what they have to do. And I think in the biological sciences, we're at the beginning of the biological sciences and making real breakthroughs. I don't know if we will make them in 30 or 40 years, but the confluence of machine learning and artificial intelligence and biology is beginning to happen. So we'll begin to understand biological processes a lot better in the future, and that's going to help us do a lot of things with biology we haven't done in the past vis-a-vis health, aging, disease, and things like that.
I also think as quantum computing comes along, it's so much faster that problems that we just don't have enough CPUs to solve now will finally be able to
That'll be a
run.
Big thing. There's another interesting approach which is going to come out. I saw a presentation the other day again at the SOC where one of the scientists had asked the question, how is it that fruit flies know what's something healthy to drink and what's something not healthy to drink. And you think about it, the fruit fly is engaged in a computational problem very similar to what Google is involved in or Spotify is involved in or machine learning is involved in, where you have to take an image and look at it and decide, or in this case, a smell, decide it's okay and not okay. And they went through this presentation and they showed how machine learning, the kind of machine algorithms machine learning does to solve this problem. And then they showed the kind of algorithms which the fruit fly uses. And it turns out they're very different and that the nature-based algorithm is more efficient than the human-based algorithm. So part of what we will learn in the future is better ways to do things in part by learning how nature does things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, nature's been solving problems for 500 million years.
Okay? But we have come a long way with machine learning.
We have a long way. But in biology, our model is still insulin, right? You have a problem, we either cut it out or we give you something. Okay? But the human body is a system. Feedback loops are as important as the direct stuff. And I think over the next 30 or 40 years, we'll learn so much more about those interactions that we'll be able to make terrific progress in the biological problems we face with our aging and disease. And so I'm optimistic about that. So on the important things, I'm optimistic about climate. I'm optimistic about health and biology. I'm worried about politics, because I see that spinning off in the wrong direction. And that could be the thing which prevents the politics can be the difference between a utopian and a dystopian future.
Yeah, so my summary would be you believe that human capability can solve our problems.
I do.
If human capability doesn't get in the way.
Right.
I don't know if you want to call human politics capability.
Well, I am not a zero sum guy. People can work together, grow the pie, and then they can divide it up rather than focus on dividing it up. And, you know, if you look around the world, there are a lot of cultures which are zero-sum cultures. I can only get better by taking away from you. This country was built on a non-zero-sum game approach.
Now, I love this little boat someone once gave me where everybody is rowing at the same pace in the same direction. It's a beautiful thing when everybody's right. in agreement and moving together.
Right. Yeah. It's also a beautiful thing when there's one person who's marching to his own drum or her own drum.
But they are more successful when they're able to lead and convince others of that direction.
When they convince them that they're actually the right person. I agree with that.
Yeah. So you have any questions for me?
My question for you is, when you talk to people, your climate champions, are they in general optimistic or are they in general just overwhelmed by the challenge?
Nobody has seemed overwhelmed to me. Everybody seems optimistic, but I think some are more nervous than others. For example, I will just use my own belief.
Okay.
We are already seeing impact, and we're not going to change fast enough to see no impact or no growth of impact. I think we will see more weather events. We will see food shortages potentially and flooding and drought increase, but I totally believe we're going to find a way to solve this. Otherwise, why would I be devoting my time
right.
to doing this? And that's, I think the most common feeling is that we have issues, but we can find a way out.
If we start viewing climate as a problem rather than an issue, we will make solutions.
I agree 100%.
You know, and we need to stop arguing about it and say, here's how we're going to solve the problem.
Everybody's got to get on board. Let's solve it and we can do anything.
And we don't need heroes and demons. We need problems and solutions. And if we have problems and solutions, I think we'll come up with an answer to this problem. And it'll require, as you said, all of the above. It's going to require conservation. It's going to require technology. It's going to require advances in low carbon generation. It's going to require smart grids. It's going to require lots of things. But it's going to require plants.
Yeah, I'm really lucky in that what I do, I get to see what's out there and what's being done. And that also makes me an optimist. I'm very excited by all the solutions that I see.
Yes.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to say before I wrap it up?
No, I think this has been enjoyable. I enjoyed meeting you. I enjoyed being able to talk about it. I'm excited, and I look forward to joining a large number of people when we solve this problem.
All right. Well, I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm going to do it with a rap. You're Howard Newman, you're an amazing investor, and you want to see plants, carbon, sequester. You like the Salk. They're doing things, you know. They're helping plants grow. It was the scientist, Joanne, and she did warn, but she had a solution, and it was corn. But what excited me, your ideas, they were the most. But you also said in 25 years, we may all be toast. You know that there's more cork we could put in, and if we do, we'll win. So we've got to find a way to multiply Suberin.
There was one rhyme there, which was great. Investing in Sequest, I like that.
Although it was sobering to hear Howard Newman's blunt statement said so matter-of-factly, that's 2.5 parts per million, and so in 25 years, that's a lot of carbon, and we're all toast, it does set the tone for an attitude of let's do something about this versus arguing if there's a problem. If you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you have any comments or questions, or if someone you know is a climate champion, or if you're a climate champion, please let me know at www.crivatenergyinnovations.com. Amy and I performed together at her improv theater, Finest City Improv, in the Hillcrest section of San Diego. If you're in town and you want a diverse variety of improv and some great entertainment, please order tickets at www.finestcityimprov.com or just drop by. If you email me first, I'll confirm when I'm performing, and sometimes I sing. I've often discussed the four waves of technology that I believe will bring about a carbon-free electric world: renewable energy, batteries, control technologies, and long-term energy storage. And maybe more important, to also electrify transportation. But Howard points out how difficult it is for people to change, especially in a world addicted to energy. Carbon sequestration provides us with time, an opportunity to fix the damage we've already done, and will also give us time to change, which could be a while. Thank you, Howard, and all philanthropists everywhere for investing in the future of our planet and helping to mitigate climate change.